385. 386 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. At this point we may with profit consider a few lines from the famous Chaldean oracles, the mind of the father uttered. That all should be divided into three. His will nodded assent. And at once all things were so divided. In response to the decree of the fourth thinker, he who governs all things with the mind of the eternal, the root division was thus ordered. In every cosmos there shineth a triad, of which a monad is the source. And further, from this triad the Father mixed every spirit, arming both mind and soul with triple might, issuing from the paternal foundation and established in the generations, man thus possesses three moving spirits which collectively are one spirit, the prime mover, the unmoved yet all-moving agent. It is natural, therefore, that each part of man should incline toward its own essential nature, being drawn thereto by a subtle gravity. That spirit which is from God, since it is the most subtle, consequently escapes back into God, the thrice beyond that spirit which is of the soul, inclines toward the celestial spheres, since it finds its affinity in the stars of whose substance it is composed, while that spirit which is of the body is drawn downward to mingle its agencies with the dark earth, its common parent. Thus, while these three agencies are combined in the making of man, they still preserve certain individual characteristics, and pursuant to the line of expression indigenous to each, seek to move the soul nature in one direction or another. The salt of the alchemists is but the terrestrial nature, the sulfur the celestial, and the mercury the sidereal. From the blending of these three spirits the hermetists brought into existence the philos, offers stone. In our analysis of man we first regard him as a threefold being epitomizing in a single nature the whole order of universal. The three powers, or monads, enthroned within his nature become vortices of force around which move respectively the substances of the supreme, the superior, and the inferior spheres, objectifying environments from their own constitution. These monads surround themselves with spheres of consciousness that have their analogy in the universal planes or worlds. Thus the supreme world outside of man exists within man as the environment of his divine spirit, the superior world in the environment of the soul spirit, and the inferior world in the environment of the body spirit. The three monads are also included within each other. The first includes the second and third, the second is included in the first but includes the third, while the third, including within its nature, neither of the others, is included within them both. Hence, spirit includes both soul and body, soul includes body, but is included within spirit, and body, being the least of the parts, includes neither spirit nor soul but is included within both. The sphere of man's divine spirit is consequently his heaven world, and his inferior nature exists within this heaven even as the earth floats within the constitution of the sidereal organism. The sphere of the soul is man's human world, where suspended between the superior and the inferior the rational judgment may be inclined by the will to the contemplation of either extreme. The sphere of the body is the inferior world which, analogous to the vast organism of the elements, seeks to swallow up consciousness and hold the innate life within the dark embrace of form. Thus the universal man is mirrored in the individual man, in whose parts and members are revealed the laws and processes of cosmic procedure. The mysteries instructed man in the nature of his own invisible constitution, revealing to him the structure of the microcosmos of which his spirit was the guiding part. They first informed the disciple that the physical organism, devoid of permanence and rationality, and far from being the master of the life, was simply a whimsical gesture, as it were, of the soul. To the initiated, the very death of the body was proof of the immortality of the soul, for it signified that separation in which a stronger nature deserted a weaker. The body and the soul were likened to two runners, the first being subject to fatigue, but the second tireless. For a while they keep abreast of each other. The body, however, having exhausted the vitality that had been loaned to it, soon lagged behind. A philosophic consideration of man 387. 388 lectures on ancient philosophy. But the soul, being tireless because its vitality was inherent, rapidly outdistanced the body, which was eventually forced to discontinue the unequal struggle because of exhaustion. Thus, while it is natural for forms to perish, it is also natural for the soul to continue in a vital state for a long period of time. By rational unfoldment it gradually inclines towards spirit, until it finally mingles its own essences with those of immortality. In Platonism we find the soul continually engendering forms, and after having accomplished the purposes for which the forms were designed, casting them aside to redirectionalize its own energies. The Greeks held that both life and death were administered by the soul, declaring that so-called acts of providence were but the will of the soul for the body which it had fashioned, and of whose destiny it was the arbiter. In his treatise on suicide, Plotinus describes the difference between natural and violent death thus: but it is requisite to remain in life, until the whole body is separated from the soul. And when it does not require migration, but is entirely external to the body. After what manner, therefore, is the body separated from the soul? When no longer anything pertaining to the soul is bound in the body? For when this takes place, the body can no longer bind the soul, the harmony of it no longer exists, which the soul possessing, it also possessed. What, then, shall we say, if someone should endeavor to separate the body from the soul? May we not say, that in this case, he must employ violence, and that he departs, but the body does not depart from him? To which may be added, that he who effects the separation, is not liberated from passion, but is under the influence of some molestation, or pain, or anger. If, also, a fated time is allotted to each individual of the human race, a separation of the body from the soul cannot be prosperous prior to this period, unless, as we have said, this becomes necessary. In the quotation it is arcanely hinted that under certain conditions the soul which is, as it were, mixed throughout the substances of the body is caused to pass out therefrom, and hover about the body, proximate to it but not entangled. A philosophic consideration of man 389. By the physical organism. When the concerns of the soul are liberated from the concerns of the body, the whole nature of the soul inclines away from form, gradually severing its connection therewith until at last having nothing in common with bodies it retires from them into itself. This is in truth the philosophic death, in which there is not a violent but a gradual segregation of interests. Under normal conditions, the complete separation of the soul from the body is not achieved during a single lifetime, but the soul voluntarily withdraws itself from a decrepit or depleted body because that body is no longer an instrument of rational liberation. Thus, in natural death the soul simply casts off a worn-out organism to continue its functions in some newer and more adequate vehicle. Suicide was considered by the ancients to be a misdirection of power, For whereas natural death is a gesture of the body, in natural death the soul casts off the body, but in suicide the body casts off the soul. Hence such an end is termed violent. For the soul is forcibly ejected from its form without the libera tion granted by rational procedure. In his Scholia on the Phaedo of Plato, Olympiodorus declares suicide to be permissible to the wise under five conditions, which specifies the circumstances under which pollution of the divine nature might not be countenanced by the individual. He epitomizes his argument in these words: suicide is unlawful when committed for the sake of the body, but rational when committed for the sake of the soul. Here we have to a certain degree the fundamental tenet of the samurai: death before dishonor. Suicide is therefore unjustifiable to escape misfortune and affliction or to evade responsibilities, but a legitimate end when it represents the sacrifice of life for the good of the nation or the service of the gods. Under justifiable suicide, the ancients would have classed the deeds of heroes who faced death in the service of the state, as well as the heroism of illustrious men and women of modern times who have willingly given their lives for the cause of science. 390 Lectures on Ancient Philosophy. Notables among such contemporaneous martyrs are those who have died from experimentation with the X-ray and radium. The first philosophers declared the rational soul to be the spirit's most precious attribute, that it should be reverenced as a god and its dictates never consciously transgressed by will or deed. There is a god within the soul of man, a god which blesses by its approach and curses by its departure. This most exalted spirit quickens the life and renders real the whole purpose of existence. When man serves this inner power, it is strengthened, and through the soul, its mediator, approaches the inferior man and lends its glory to terrestrial achievements. Conversely, if the life be ill, the spirit withdraws to the point of greatest isolation, whereupon the soul, overcome by the noxious fumes of materiality, is said to die. Thus a man may actually be dead in his inner nature while still alive in his outer. After the disintegration of his own soul, he becomes a slave to the demons or spirits residing in the astral light. These agitate his internal parts, causing them to assume the appearance of normal functioning. Such a person, however, is severed from all relations with his divine part. Sorcerers, vampires, and werewolves are thus declared to have lost their souls, being but outer shells from which the inner life has fled, or more correctly, decayed. Materiality hardens the nature, and we frequently hear the expression that this or that person has no soul. This does not mean philosophically that the soul is necessarily dead, but that the eyes of the soul have been blinded by the concerns of the body. It is not sufficient that man should live physically and exist in the divine sphere as a vortex of reality, it is also necessary that his soul, composed of the astral light, should be caused to verge toward reality and thus impregnate the entire organism with those virtues which are resident in the seven spheres. Here a most vital question is introduced, namely, why should a man be virtuous? According to the materialist, a certain measure of personal integrity is necessary for the success of the physical community life of the race. From the theological outlook, a little virtue coupled with a plenitude of